Six music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to a new series of The First Time here on Six Music. This is the show where we speak to some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around about the significant musical firsts that have shaped their lives and their careers. Today's guest is one of the most controversial figures in alternative rock, but also one of its most important figureheads. It's Courtney Love. Courtney has had a remarkable life so far. Born in San Francisco, she submerged herself in the UK post-punk scene of the 80s, going on to become a member of Babes in Toyland and then leader of the band Hole, where she cut a defiant and unapologetic figure making equally powerful music, like Hole's 1991 debut, Pretty on the Inside. Just a year after that, she married Nirvana frontman Kurt Cobain. In the years that followed, the couple were surrounded by controversy at every turn, not least for reports of their serious drug use. 4 days after Cobain's suicide on April the 5th, 1994, Hole released Live Through This, a deeply personal and brilliant album that would break them worldwide and prove that Love's songwriting was more than equal to the controversy that she'd been generating. Hole released two more albums before fracturing in 2002, by which time Courtney had taken up acting, become mired in legal issues surrounding her late husband's estate, and found herself loved and loathed by the media and music fans in equal measures. Despite her often turbulent life, Courtney has survived and remains as outspoken and unbowed as ever, as you'll hear. And the first question I asked Courtney, as I do with all my guests on the first time, was, when was she first aware of music?
My parents listened to a lot of Dylan and Beatles, not so much Stones, but my first record was Leonard Cohen.
That was your first record?
Yeah, that's I just took it from my mother's collection. They never even opened it. So,
really?
Yeah.
That's a strong record to be starting with.
Yeah. I'm glad I started with that record, though.
What appealed to you about Leonard?
Well, everything, really. The lyrics that, I mean, he was so lyric conscious and morbid, and I was... pretty morbid kid, and you know, the real angst on it.
Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river. You can hear the boats go by, you can spend the night beside her, and you know that she's half crazy, but that's why you wanna be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China. And just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her, then she gets you on her wavelength, and she lets the river answer that you've always been her lover. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know that she will trust you, for you've touched her perfect body with your mind.
And then the next record, because they were in a record club, so they'd get all these records every month, so it's called the Columbia Record Club. Everyone in America from that generation knows what it was. It was a penny, and you'd get records every month. And then the next record, I think, was Beggar's Banquet.
So you started just right in there with, like, some big quality albums.
Yeah.
Was
and
music-
then I went out and bought Electric Light Orchestra's Evil Woman.
Which is a big tune as well.
It's a tune. It was my first single.
Good.
Were you always drawn to music? Was it always something that you found yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I remember staring at the cover of Bob Dylan's Bringing It All Back Home and going, oh, I want to live like that. I want to live like that.
So when did that start to become like, well, I could maybe do something like that?
When I was in I was a ward of the state, it was in Oregon, which is a state in our country, this hippie counselor came back from the UK, but he came back with Patti Smith's record of Horses and also Pretenders, Pretenders. And I was like, wow, job option. Cool.
Tell me about Patti Smith. I've done this show with lots of people, and I did it with Michael Stipe a while ago, and he extolled his passion for her is just limitless.
It is limitless.
What's
his passion for her outranks his passion for me, which gets me rather jealous sometimes. I mean, because he's a great mentor, and I'm especially close with him, and he's my father, he's the godfather of my daughter and stuff.
Do you remember first meeting her?
Yeah, I do. It was here. And no, it was in New York, and it was not climactic in the sense of, you know, sometimes it's best if you don't meet your heroes, you know what I mean? I mean, Michael and Patty are tight as thieves. I'm fine when I see her, but I don't get all, you know, fangirl.
You mentioned The Pretenders. When was the moment you kind of fell in love with her? Because she's an awesome musician, a fantastic
great
icon.
Songwriter.
Although she'd hate the word icon, I think.
From the opening track, I mean, she's amazing. And she's, you know, a great guitar player and constructing those songs that are great. She even has a Christmas song. Christmas songs are where all the money is. If you can write a good Christmas song, you're in for life. You're set, man.
Have you ever tried writing a Christmas song?
Yeah, I have, actually. With Billy Corgan, and it didn't come out so well. But, I mean, don't you have Wizard has one? I mean, doesn't Slade have one in every Christmas you play? You know.
What was yours called?
I can't remember. I honestly can't remember.
I'm just trying to picture like a video with you guys sort of all in Christmas gear. You
know? Yeah, me and Billy.
Another important first. Your first gig, what was the first gig that you went to that really made an impact?
Probably the Virgin Prunes in Dublin in like 1980.
What do you remember of that?
It was just really scary. It was really scary.
Why?
They were like really, they looked like they were 9 feet tall and they had black hair that was in these giant piles of quiffs and they were wearing garbage bags and it was scary. I liked it.
What were your first kind of experiences coming over to Ireland? I mean, must have been a pretty interesting time.
Well, I mean, I'd never seen Top of the Pops or music like that. I lived in New Zealand, I lived here, but I had never been exposed to the musical culture. And it was a really interesting time. It was when U2 was first starting. And the Smiths hadn't even started yet. New Order hadn't started yet. So it was like, that's the period of time I was here. And then I went off to Liverpool and sort of, and would go to Echo and the Bunnymen's rehearsals. And that was really, that was school. That was like going to college.
You went to the rehearsals?
Yeah, it was great.
Was watching Mac a kind of way of learning how
everything. I stole every move that guy, between Stipe and McCulloch, I've stolen every move they make. So, you know, with Michael, I do this. My hands. You know, I'll do hand shapes. And with McCulloch, I stole my foot on the monitor from Johnny Cash or Nick Cave, but there's also a fellow in between that was Julian Cope,
who's
the one that got me to Liverpool. We were just listening to another radio station in the car, and Reward came on, and I said, this didn't date well, but... It didn't. It's got horns all over the thing, you know.
I quite like that track.
Yeah. Until I learn to accept my reward. 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 I still do sing in a British accent, though.
You love the Brit scene that much, you think it's like...
No. It's just part of, from stealing from people, I sing in a British accent.
When you first started playing the guitar, what were the first songs you learnt to play?
The first song was Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley. Second was Danny Boy. You know, just your average... And the guitar was very big for my hands. So my mother had got me a guitar that was too big. And I ended up really fighting with the guitar teacher because he didn't want to teach me stuff I wanted to learn. I learned Suzanne. I learned Paint It Black. So when I got my first electric and like a little pig nose amp, and then I could learn songs that I liked.
Who are your heroes then? Who are your guitar heroes? Apart from the people we've talked about.
Well, I'm a shite guitar player, really.
You have flair, though. You have a sound.
I have a sound. it's not what it was, but I can write a song. I just can't execute it so well. But I would say, I might shock you right now. I think Brian May is really tasteful. Dave Navarro can be really, really shreddy and lame, but other times he can be really tasteful. Peter Bach, Keith, trying to think, Gallagher.
It's about sound over technicality then.
No, because Corgan is one of the greatest bass players, actually. He's a better bass player, I think, than he is a guitar player.
He's a hell of a guitar player.
Yeah, he's a hell of a guitar player, but he just can't seem to get over the lump and, like, become relevant again. It's really weird. He's doing all sorts of wacky doodle things to do that, and it just doesn't seem to really work for him.
You go and see him live, and they're still phenomenal. They're still great live.
Yeah, I'm sure he is.
Is there a Pumpkins tune that you have a particular fondness for?
Yeah, because there's so many of them that are about me.
But that's it. Pick one about you.
Let's see. Most of Siamese Dream is about me. No, I think I put it on. There's a song called Bodies, and then there's that's a Melancholy, and then there's Today, and there's...
Is that about you?
Yeah, it is.
That's nice.
Tonight, there's...
You're just reeling off a list of, like, amazing Smashing Pumpkins songs, aren't you, really?
I know. And then he stopped writing about me, and then he stopped having hits. I don't know what that's about. And they're not all about me. One's about me and Trent. And how mad he was about that. But, and that one's called, I think it's called Where Boys Fear to Tread. I can't remember. But not everything on Melancholy is about me. There's another girl started coming around and he started writing about her. But it's a mix. Siamese Dream is pretty much, there's one song called Space Boy about his brother. The rest are pretty much about me.
I'll tear my heart out.
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and that was Today by The Smashing Pumpkins, a song written about my guest this week, Courtney Love.
This is Six Music.
Six Music.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Oh, make me over. I'm all I want to be. A walking study in demonology. Hey, so glad you could make it. Yeah, now you really made it. Hey, so glad you could make it now. Oh, look at my
I'm Matt Everett, this is Six Music, and this is The First Time. This is the show where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is one of the most controversial people in alternative rock, Courtney Love. And that was Celebrity Skin, the first and title track from Hole's third album from 1998. So Hole's first ever single was 1990's Retard Girl. I asked Courtney what memories she had from those early recording sessions.
It took about 20 minutes and cost like my savings, which was like $500.
You paid for the whole thing yourself?
Yeah.
What can you remember from that time? Because you seemed so ambitious to break through and make a statement and have people hear your music. It seemed to be this force of nature at that time.
Yeah. Well, I was. I mean, I had a 5-year plan and was very strategic about things and read every rock critic, and so I knew their taste and what they liked. And
was there a strategy then?
Yeah, absolutely. Really? Had a strategy. Backdoor through the UK, and then you get respected in the US. That's how it used to work anyway. But I mean, it works, still does. Lana Del Rey did it.
What were the first Hole rehearsals like? Can you remember?
Yeah, Flea from the Peppers loaned us his studio. Their studio, and we would work in the night because they work in the day, and I would strip in the day to make the money to buy the vans and back lines and the guitars and the drums and the snares and all those things. So I was very good at saving money.
And what were they like as a unit? Did it come together quite quickly?
The first lineup I knew was not going to be permanent, but I worked them 6 to 7 days a week. So
and worked them, that's a great word.
Yeah, well, they complained about it a lot, and they were like, the Chili Peppers don't work 6 or 7 days a week. I'm like, well, we're not the Chili Peppers. I don't see us selling out the Starwood, so this is back way, way, way back. This is like 1987.
What did people make of the band for those first gigs?
No, I'm sorry, it's 88. The first gigs, it was during metal, so it was during sort of poodle metal. It was during sort of Poison and Warren and Cinderella and all that crap. And L.A. Guns, Hollywood Guns, and, which turned into Hollywood Rose, turned into Guns N' Roses. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to be the freaky girl that they have to come see after hours.
What do you mean?
Like, let's go see that freaky girl. Because I didn't want to move to Seattle, because I knew there was a big scene up in Seattle, but I'd either die or get chased out of town in a month, you know. One block from the Greyhound station, I went, no. I will get kicked out of this town or die. I could smell the heroin in the air. You could smell it.
When was the first time you tried heroin? Can you remember?
Yeah, it was an accident. I was in Hong Kong, and I was at a Dime a Dance Club. You know, I was a dancing girl.
All right.
With a number around my chest. And there was one German girl there. Other than that, I was the only other white girl there. And there was these petrol cans full of gowns. And none of the gowns fit me, so it came down to, like, my knee. And it had a star on the breast. And I remember this because there was this Filipino shipping tycoon, and he wanted to do cocaine. And this girl said, oh, I can get it. And she went and she got this cocaine. And I didn't have any fondness for cocaine, you know, ever. I had a cocaine phase once for about 9 months in my entire life. And it was documented and terrible, and everyone knows about it, and there's pictures, and it's just an embarrassment. But I took a very small snort, and I woke up. I woke up on a plane back to San Francisco. So it wasn't enjoyable. It wasn't anything I remember particularly liking. I just woke up on a plane back to San Francisco in that dress, in the dress with the star on the boob that came down to my knee.
Yeah.
Your first, I say the first hit would be Doll Parts. Would you call that the first hit? Did you enjoy, did you feel justification when you finally got that recognition? After working for so long and working with so many different people to finally go, I've got recognition. People like this music that I've been trying to...
Yeah, I mean, I did. At the time, though, you know, it was right after Kurt died, so it was like a lot was going on. You know, I had a baby, and so there was a lot going on in terms of my responsibilities and stuff like that. And I was having to go into arbitration, legal stuff about his estate, a couple times a week. So I'd have to fly back to Seattle and do that when I was on the road. And also, I didn't understand, you know, the whole thing with, you know, death taxes and, you know, wills getting thrown out and da-da-da-da-da.
If I can ask you about Kurt, we are doing first. So what were your first impressions of him when you first met him?
I thought he was really cute, but I really didn't like their first single. I didn't like Love Buzz. I knew the song. I knew it was a cover. And I thought it was cute. I thought it was funny and very enigmatic and dry. You know, I had a crush. A lot of girls had a crush on him. But he wasn't aware of it.
What, the crush or you?
He wasn't aware of girls having crushes on him. He just didn't, he didn't know he was a good-looking guy.
Really?
Didn't know. Nope. Took me years to convince him you are a technically handsome man.
Which in itself is quite a handsome trait in somebody, not knowing.
Yeah, yeah. But then the minute I told him that, he did all these things to make himself ugly, like dye his hair red and wear crazy goggle glasses and da-da-da. Like, you know, he's like, where's the blue-eyed blonde boy? What happens? With the nice little sweater. Where'd he go?
I'm fascinated just the scale of attention that you guys got. I can't imagine what that would feel like when the eyes of the world are constantly
on
you.
Oh, it feels like war.
I mean, did it feel... They say that the centre of a hurricane is quite calm. It didn't look calm.
Oh, no, at home was calm, but right, anything okay. Outside of home was not calm.
How does anyone deal with that?
Isolated. Just, we isolated. Me, him, our kid, our nanny, boom, no one's allowed in, except the dealer. That's it. Just isolated, didn't socialize with anybody.
Live through this big commercial record. Then you've got the world is recognition. It's not just kind of the enemy and the odd cool club here and there. All of a sudden
right.
You've got, you're a big star. Do you enjoy that attention? For the music, not for anything
well,
else.
I mean, people evolve. At the time, I enjoyed it.
What do you mean?
Well, I don't enjoy it anymore. I'm very glad, for instance, I've been in London for a week almost, and I haven't been papped once, and it's really nice. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I used to be like...
I don't know what you mean. I never get papped. How would I know about that?
Well, you do know what I mean. If there's something that just, like, that you used to think was just acceptable, and now you can't stand it. It's like, I see a paparazzi, I'm like, I just put my hand up. I want to make the picture worthless. So, you know.
I am the girl you know can't look you in the eye. I am the girl you know so sick I cannot try. I am the one you want can't look you in the eye. I am the girl you know I lie and lie and lie.
All of a sudden, the whole thing has kind of moved away. But that's something that you're kind of revisiting now. What changed?
What do you mean?
With Hole. That's a big shift.
To say that I'll do it again, you mean?
Mm, yeah.
I was talking with Dave Navarro, and he was talking about touring with Janes and how he and Perry have separate buses. And he just kind of talked some sense to me. And we're also the last to the dance. I mean, in terms of those reunion things, I mean, Nine Inch Nails have done like 3 victory laps. Soundgarden does it every year. I said to Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, you guys, Rage never did a reunion tour. What are you talking about? 2007 to 2011. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what? You know, and I'm like, okay, well, I'm not doing it without new music, without new songs that are being played.
Because the two tracks that we've heard, the first stuff we've heard from you since America's Sweetheart, which is You Know My Name, and Wedding Day, it's still pretty uncompromising stuff. It's pretty... Yeah. You're grinning.
Yeah.
Was it, right, I will come out and I'm going to do something that will take the top of people's heads off.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, there were 6 other songs that I didn't release. They were more like stoner songs and whatever. These were just too, like, you know, under 3 minutes, right to your face.
Say
Still enjoy it as much as you used to, the playing.
Yeah, I do. I
despite like everything, despite the attention that you're talking about.
It's not the attention, it's the that I've been doing it for so long, you can get a little bored of it, but I still, I'm lucky enough that I have some genetic predisposition to enjoying it, so I do.
Because when America's Sweetheart came out, it didn't really connect with your audience.
No.
In a way that maybe you would have liked it, and it there kind of seemed to be, is he going to stop making music? Did you think about that at that point?
Yeah, I mean, I just didn't care about anything at all at that point.
Why?
Well, a lot of really complicated reasons, and we're not doing a Guardian interview, so...
can you describe them in simple terms?
Legal, just financial stuff, and, you know, just it was taking over my life. It was like the Tribbles and Star Trek, you know, it was just like...
Breeding everywhere,
you know, boxes with 102 credit card receipts in them, and, you know, where did these come from? I don't have 102 credit cards, I mean, crazy stuff. So that was what was more concerning to me, the music. I was like, they're stealing my daughter and my... fortune, these lawyers that I have, and I don't know what to do about it.
When do we hear more stuff? Is it all as screechingly aggressive as that?
I have no idea. The other six songs that I threw off aren't as screechingly... I wanted as screechingly as you're talking about. I guess it's become a trademark, really. You know, scream singing. But it is hard to maintain. I mean, I have to go see a doctor after this to make sure that I can do it, you know, every single night. I'm 49, I'm almost 50.
People kind of almost expect it from you. You are, you know, it's a phrase I used the other day with Chrissy Hynde and she hated it. This idea of being like an icon, but you kind of become an icon because you don't give a hell about wanting to be an icon. People expect a certain level of passion from you in your performances and in your music all the time. That's got to be difficult to live with sometimes. People have a preconceived idea of who you are.
Yeah, that is difficult to live with. So I win them over one person at a time.
It's a long strategy.
So I'm playing the long game, baby.
Final question. You get to pick the last song that we play in the show.
So play Bittersweet Symphony.
Oh, why that choice?
Because it's one of my favorite songs ever. Yeah, I remember just feeling... Look, this is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful song for the ages.
And that's the song we shall finish on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to speak to you.
Nice. Likewise.
Six Music. Music.
This is the Morning After Mix.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.